Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, September 25th. First order of business is approval of the minutes from May 17th. Representative Dabney moves approval of the minutes from May 17th. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Once again today, I'm given the unique opportunity to say thank you. I want to give a shout out to the fine men and women of the Minnesota State Patrol for the exceptional job they're doing enforcing the traffic laws of the state of Minnesota. So, members, we have essentially two items on the agenda for the committee today. The first is that at the end of session, items that this committee had previously acted on that were on the general register referred back to this committee. It's my intent that the committee would take action on these bills to send them back to the general register. Some of these are already laws, so candidly, that will be just potential vehicles for future legislative action. Others will stay on the general register and not go forward. That's just the point of this. I've been notified the authors that there's no reason for them to come in. I'll present each of the bills today. Again, the committee has taken action on each of these items. If members of the committee, feel free to re-debate it if you want to, or if this is a public hearing, so members of the public can testify if they want. But again, these are all bills that the committee has taken action on, and that's the intent of those bills. Second is that we're going to be doing a research on the economic outcomes, existing development programs, demographic data for Latinos in the workforce. And so we'll be hearing from some interested stakeholders in that area. And my intent is to try to get us to adjourn out of here soon enough that we don't have to deal with the substantial traffic in the metro area due to a lot of the road construction that's going on right now. So are there any questions before we take action on these bills? By the way, it's nice to see everyone. I hope everyone had a good summer. So the first bill, oh, and members, you should have your form for per diem and mileage reimbursement. Given the budget situation, I just don't know if we'll be getting per diem or mileage on these things. It doesn't mean we will be, it doesn't mean we won't be, but obviously there's kind of there's a lot of flux right now given the budget situation for the legislative chamber. So I would just encourage members, if you want to fill out the mileage, fill out the per diem, as soon as I get authorization, I'll be certainly requesting that we get authorization to get reimbursed for that, but I just can't guarantee that until we know 100% for sure. And hope if anyone has any questions about that, just speak with me offline about it. So. They're going to give it to Megan. I think they know that, but okay. So they give it to you instead?
Yeah.
Adam's personal cell phone number is, with any questions on reimbursement. So the first, is anyone from the governor's office or the department here today? Okay, feel free, if you guys want to testify in any of these bills, just kind of give me a wave. I know, again, we have taken action on all these, and I think we've spoken in advance, so. So the chair will move, first of all, House File 1005, you recommended to pass and referred to the general register. Again, members, this is a bill the committee has taken action on. That will be the conclusion of my testimony. Is there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Allison Grubner, Department of Commerce, Government Affairs Director. As Minnesota's regulator of over 20 industries, including the state's insurance marketplace, financial institutions, securities, and energy sector, the Department of Commerce opposes the bill in front of you, which would reduce the number of deputy commissioners of the department. Again, I'll be quite brief. Cutting these roles from the department would be detrimental to the industries and ultimately Minnesota consumers. During the state agency reorganization in 1983, the legislature understood the complexity of the various industries the department regulates, and going forward decided to carve out an exception to the one deputy limit set for other agencies under the statute. Eliminating these positions will impact the economy and the economic well-being of all Minnesotans. Currently, the department has four deputy commissioners, an insurance division deputy, one for the Division of Energy Resources, one for the Financial Institutions Division, as well as our chief of staff. While the department understands the intent of the proposal, we strongly believe cutting these roles would be detrimental to the industries and ultimately Minnesota's consumers. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Darielle Dannon. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
We just similarly wanted to, again, state on the record that we are opposed to House File 1105. Similarly, we have three deputy commissioners at DEED, but we do have those deputy commissioners because we do vastly different things in different parts of our agency. My commissioner sometimes says that we are at this point sort of in many different agencies put together. And so we have a deputy commissioner who does operations, a deputy commissioner who concentrates on the workforce, which I believe we're going to talk more about today, and then a deputy commissioner who does economic development. In our opinion, those are very different things. They require a very different skill set, and so it requires that our agency to have different individuals who have that kind of expertise and experience. So with that, we are still continuing to be in opposition to this bill, and we wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you to both our testifiers. Is it safe to say that with each of the five bills today, there's been no change in the administration's position based on the previous testimony that was given during the legislative session?
Since this is the only bill that the department is following, Mr. Chair, I can't comment.
Thanks. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member comments and questions. Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this bill has come before the committee before. I don't know that any of colleagues on my side of the aisle voted for it, so I would move that we just go right to Groundhog Day.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion for House File 1005 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The motion prevails, and House File 1005 is on its way to the General Register. Next is House File 1037. Is Representative Vogel? Representative Vogel, did you want to present the bill, or do you just want to maybe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'd like your introduction of your bill, and I'd follow suit.
Right. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And if there's anyone else who wishes to testify, feel free to come on down and prepare yourself. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas from the Metropolitan Council. I'm here to state the Council's opposition to this bill, which we had noted during session. There are three elements to this bill, and I'll try to be very brief about them. First, requiring legislative approval for any Council plan related to housing, requiring legislative approval of our negotiated affordable and life cycle housing goals, and legislative approval of a municipality's affordable and life cycle housing opportunities amount for very long. The first item, we're greatly concerned about the housing plan approval because we had adopted that plan back in 2014, my apologies, and communities have been updating their local comprehensive plans since then. Many of them are nearing the completion of that process, and we reviewed seven of those so far at a preliminary state and expect to receive quite a few more plans before the end of the year and into the beginning of next year. Having to come back to the legislature for approval of those of our housing plan would throw a great deal of uncertainty into the local planning process, which many communities are completing at this point. This bill also would interfere with negotiations with local governments around the negotiated affordable and life cycle housing goals, which we do once every 10 years as part of our re-enrollment process for the Livable Communities Program. It is unclear what that interference would achieve other than undermine that process, which is already approved by local government resolution. And finally, we're unsure what the third section of this bill is meant to achieve regarding the affordable and life cycle housing opportunities amount and legislative approval or changes to that amount. The current current statute already has the formula in the bill, and you'll see it in the section right before the proposed changes, what the formula is for determining that amount. That amount is always done by that formula, and there is no approval over that, local or not. It is not a grant. It's the local expenditure that communities must make towards achieving affordable housing in their communities. With that, I have just want to restate our opposition to this bill and would stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Will the next testifier please come forward?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities in the metropolitan area at both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. I wanted to speak really specifically to Section 2 of the bill. Metro Cities does have concerns with requiring legislative approval over housing goals that are negotiated between local units of government and the Metropolitan Council for programs that are voluntary and the goals are negotiated voluntarily. There are no state dollars involved. These are regional-level programs that are funded through local property tax levy or regional but local property taxes. They are negotiated every 10 years. The bill does require an annual legislative approval or certainly at least a review. And we would just be concerned about having, again, this additional layer of governmental oversight over goals that are, again, voluntary and negotiated locally. Metro Cities does support the livable communities programs and funding for cities. These are levels of funds that provide a range of programs, including soil cleanup, certainly affordable housing, and also various types of economic development and redevelopment efforts occurring at the local level. So again, I just thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Maybe I will just add as well that Metro Cities, these goals are negotiated every 10 years, as was pointed out by the earlier testifier. And the last time that these were negotiated, and frankly, any time these are negotiated, Metro Cities would work very closely to make sure that those goals are workable for local units of government. We did that during the last round, and that's one of the reasons that our organization, frankly, exists, is to make sure that those processes are working well. And if they do need improvement, we would certainly be open to that. But we just don't think there needs to be another layer of oversight. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member comments and questions. Any closing comments from members of the committee? Rep. Vogel?
No comments.
With that, Representative Vogel renews his motion to have House File 1037 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Next on the agenda is House File 1119. Members, this is Representative Tice's bill. I'll be presenting it for her today. What this does is it increases penalties for unlicensed contractors. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the member public comment portion. Move to member questions or comments. Again, the committee has taken action on this bill. Seeing none, the chair renews his motion to have House File 1119 recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. It's on its way. And next is House File 1202. The chair recommends House File 1202 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Members, this is technical corrections to the Department of Labor and Industry. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion, move to member questions and comments. Seeing none, we'll move forward. Representative Mahoney?
Good vehicle bill. We shall vote for it.
The chairman renews his motion to have vehicle bill House File 1202 recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. Next, the chair will move House File 1394 be recommended or passed and referred to the General Register. Members, this is a dislocated worker program modification that would ban political workers from participating in the state's program. This was included in our omnibus bill, but it was it enacted in the law?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I thought so, okay. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion, move to member questions and comments. Any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. House File 1394 is passed and referred to the General Register. Thank you, members, for allowing us to get that housekeeping done with. Now, we're going to be focusing on economic outcomes, the development programs, currently within the Minnesota's demographic groups, particularly with Latinos. And so our first testifier can come forward now. I believe we're going to be hearing from Mr. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Hine. I'm the Labor Market Information Director at the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. I appreciate the opportunity to come here today to speak briefly on the question of Hispanic and Latino employment conditions. Here we go. All right. Got the technology worked out. First, I want to just point out a recent but what will be an ongoing trend in our state population. This chart shows the total population growth over the last 2 years in total, but also broken out among minorities as a whole and Hispanics as a component of that minority total, and also the number of Caucasian Minnesotans added to the population over the last 2 years. You can see there is that the increase in our total population of just under 63,000 was comprised significantly by an increase of over 55,000 to our minority population. And of that 55,600 increase in our minority population, just over 12,000 of them were of a Hispanic ethnicity. I'll point out, too, because some of the slides will focus on characteristics of our immigrant population, that's very challenging here in Minnesota, especially to disentangle the impact that ethnic and minority growth on one hand and immigrant or foreign-born population growth on the other has. In terms of our Hispanic population growth over the last 2 years, that 12,020 individuals, 46.7% of that increase was among those that were foreign-born. And for our minority population as a whole, the 55,600 increase was comprised of a foreign-born component that constituted 43.1% of that population. So again, those are very high rates relative to many, most, perhaps even all other states in the nation. If we look at the place of birth of some of the immigrants, this is speaking directly now to the role that Hispanics and Latinos have in our state and economy. Mexico is by a significant margin, by more than twice the runner-up here, the source of the most, the single source of our working age population. Besides Mexico, perhaps not a surprise that Minnesota is also strong in immigration from Southeast Asia, Laos, Vietnam, Korea, Thailand, even China and India, also other Asian countries on that list. And also Eastern Africa, with Somalia and Ethiopia providing a significant number of immigrants. Also want to bring your attention to that second column there. That acronym stands for Labor Force Participation Rate. I think it's important to note that individuals from these countries and other countries that fall farther down this list participate in our labor force at very high rates. For our white population here in Minnesota, that labor force participation rate by this source stood at 69.8%. So a majority of these groups do out-participate our white population. And I always think it's interesting to look at where we were in 1960, 55 years ago. Our immigrants of today certainly out-participate the immigrants of 1960 that were predominantly northern and eastern European in origin. As immigration tends to occur among a relatively younger cohort than the overall population, it follows, perhaps isn't too surprising then, that many of our minority groups are significantly younger than our native-born, significantly white population. It's not unusual to see some of our racial and ethnic groups being at least 40%, if not significantly higher, as is the case with our Hispanic and Mexican populations. 40% are under 21. That is, they're either just starting their working years or are yet to start. And at the other end, in those red bars, the share that are 65 and over that have aged or will be aging out of the workforce are relatively small compared again to our white population, where there's fewer than one-fourth that are under 21, and one in six are already 65 or older.
Mr. Hine, we do not have copies of this presentation, and so these numbers, I can see them right here, but I'm right next to the monitor. Would you just mind highlighting a couple of, we can kind of get
sure.
The basic, the blue line's bigger than the orange line.
Right, yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
highlight a couple of the percentages that are relevant for
sure.
Members of the committee.
Okay, the blue lines represent for each of the racial and ethnic groups here, the blue lines represent the proportion of their respective populations that are 21 or under. The highest there, but this is from a relatively small base, is for those that identify themselves as being of two or more races. That's at 56.2%. The Hmong alone, those that identify as being Mexican of origin, 46.4% are below the age of 21. The Hmong, the Hispanic overall, and black or African-American citizens are also disproportionately in that younger age cohort, being 21 or lower. At the other end of the age distribution, as depicted by the red bars, white alone, 16.5% of our white population here in Minnesota is already of retirement age. That compares to 2.6% of those identifying as Mexican and 2.8% that are identified as Hispanic or Latino. And again, none of these racial or ethnic groups have an older age cohort that is of the size that the white population does. Questions?
Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may not have this in this presentation, but do you or does your department have statistics on the training or the education levels of this group of 21 and under minority groups that you have on these charts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I do have a chart here that will show some of the important information on educational attainment. It may not answer precisely what you're asking, but I can certainly pursue some of those as well. Thank you.
Representative Scott, and then Mr. Hine, we'll let you kind of finish up your presentation, then we'll move back for more questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I know you're midstream and you usually like to do this after the presentation, but I had a question on the labor force participation rates.
Mm-hmm.
Could you kind of define what goes into that figure? Is it all people that are just, on somebody's payroll, or does it include self-employed people? Does it include farmers? Can you help me understand what that
Representative Scott, to be in the labor force, one has to either be working or actively looking for work, okay? And the participation rate is that share of the working age population, non-institutionalized, civilian, so we exclude prison populations and armed forces. But it's that share of the working age population that are either working or are actively looking for work and therefore are deemed to be unemployed, officially unemployed.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
The rest, then, are not in the labor force. They're not working and they're not looking for work.
And so how do you judge whether they're working or not? Is they're paying taxes? How How do you know someone is classified as working?
These data are based on a household survey that's conducted every year called the American Community Survey. There are other surveys, such as the current population survey, that we also use to compile information on employment status. But they are surveys that individuals complete themselves. So they self-report whether they're working. Okay? The survey asks, did you work for pay or not during the week of the 12th of last month or something of that sort? If they respond that they were not working, then they're asked whether they actively sought work so that they qualify to be considered unemployed.
Representative Scott.
Thank you.
Representative Gaines, did you have a question as well?
Just an observation. I'm looking at the first page, and we are talking about 5% of a total state population.
Representative Gaines, this presentation is actually different than the one that's up there right now.
Okay, well, so. But it's relevant.
Okay.
I think it's relevant. When we're dealing with percentages rather than hard numbers, I think we're getting a wrong picture because at base, we are talking about 5% of the state's total population. And so I'm not seeing a clear picture because we are only talking about 5% of the state's total population. And that's just, sometimes percentages hide things or skew things. And I think raw numbers in this case might be more helpful.
Well, they say there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics, right?
So, kind of like that.
Yeah. Mr. Ryan, if you want to continue with your presentation, please.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, do you want me to respond to that, or present the 2-year change in our population among these populations? You're right that the Hispanic population in aggregate is much smaller than the minority population as a whole, and even than our white population. But that 12,000 increase in our population from the relatively small base of about 288,000 Hispanics in our state does represent a 4.3% increase, significantly more than the 1.2% increase overall and the 0.2% increase among our white population. I guess my point in presenting this slide is to show the significant share of our population growth that has occurred over the last 2 years by virtue of growth in our overall minority population, highly correlated with our overall immigrant population, and specifically the role that our Hispanic and Latino population plays in this growth. Over a quarter of our overall population growth here in Minnesota over the last 2 years has come among our Hispanic population. And those are trends that are not only going to continue, but are going to become more pronounced in the years ahead as our native-born white population moves further and further into their retirement years and ages out of the workforce and ages out of life. So,
please continue with your presentation.
Thank you. So I did have a more detailed breakout. I believe that the next presentation will include some of this, so I won't belabor this. But I did want to note the median age among our Hispanic population, consistent with this very young distribution, 24.4 years, compared to our white non-Hispanic median age of 42. You can see the very large share, almost one in three individuals in that Hispanic population are of an age where they will be entering our workforce over the next 10 to 15 years. So there'll continue to be this large influx of not only Hispanics, but emphasizing, concentrating on their role here for this
purpose. They'll continue to be a growing share of our population. And we see that in our labor growth, labor force statistics as well, even to a greater extent by virtue of the relatively high participation rates and the relatively young age distribution of these minority populations and our Hispanic population as a whole. Again, over 90% of all our labor force growth has been among minorities over the last 2 years. And that is a share that is very likely, if not certain, to increase significantly over the next 15 years, as it's projected that our white population that will be participating in the labor force is actually projected to shrink over many of the next 10 to 15 years. Again, over one-fourth of our labor force growth has been among those that identify as Hispanic. So these past 2 years, I want to really emphasize, are sort of the tip of the iceberg. Now, this gets at Representative Mahoney's question. In order to get at the question of what explains the relatively low-paying, low-income employment outcomes of individuals of Hispanic ethnicity, obviously one of the most glaring challenges that our Hispanic population faces is that 37.4% of those that are 25 or older. So this isn't accounted for by the fact that nearly 30% of Hispanics are between 5 and 17 years of age and therefore have not graduated yet. This is among those that are 25 or older. And over a third of them lack a high school diploma. And of course, at the other end of the educational scale, they correspondingly lack post-secondary credentials. Other challenges that the Hispanic population face include language barriers. Nearly a third of those that identify as Hispanic say that they speak English less than very well. 17.6% lack health care insurance coverage, and 17% of Hispanic families are below the poverty rate. These challenges and educational attainment have consequences for the types of employment that we often see being held by those of Hispanic ethnicity. This is a list, I think it's the top 15 occupations held by Hispanic males on one hand and Hispanic females on the other. And as you can see, if you can skim through this list, that on the male side we see a preponderance of occupations that fall into food service, construction, but specifically construction laborers, roofers, and painters appear on this list. A janitorial occupations as well as ag populations appear as among the top occupations held by Hispanic males. Hispanic females, on the other hand, appear in high numbers and high proportions in occupations like maids and cleaners. Personal care attendants, home health aides, and child care workers are all on this list, as well as a number of the food service occupations. So the types of employment that this population finds itself in certainly explains a relative lack of a relative disadvantage in terms of household income. So just to review, Hispanics, both native and foreign-born, do participate in the labor force at high rates, 77% among those that identify Mexico as their place of origin. That's the case with all of our immigrant populations. Makes me wonder why we let all those Northern Europeans in 55 years ago with their low participation rates. But I was one of them. Also, as with all immigrant communities, Hispanics tend to be much younger than our workforce in general, and in particular, our native-born white population. And so over the last 2 years and in the years to come, minorities and immigrants will be probably the only source of any workforce growth that our state will experience. We do see Hispanics experiencing much lower levels of educational attainment, specifically in terms of that high proportion that lack a high school diploma, although this may change as young Hispanics go into post-secondary programs or enter the workforce. So as a result, we do see many of those individuals, vast majority, in fact, of our population of Hispanic ethnicity being employed in low-paying jobs. With that, I'll gladly take any questions.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you mentioned this American Community Survey. Are you saying that most of the data from your PowerPoint has come from results from that survey?
Mr. Chair, member, yes. Much of the data that requires that we break out our population into numerous subgroups on whether it be minority or racial or ethnic or age or whatever, requires the kind of survey that has enough of a sample to allow us to do that breakout. So much of what I have presented here, comes from that American Community Survey.
Mr. Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. I've had a couple of constituents contact me with wondering about that survey, and it's legitimate, but I think it's also conducted in part through the U.S. Census Bureau, and if that's correct, the census comes every 10 years, so if somebody relatively new comes to the state of the country, how would they be included in a survey such as this?
Mr. Ryan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, you're absolutely right. In fact, the American Community Survey replaces what used to be called the long form during the decennial census. The decennial census now is limited to basically the headcount necessary for political redistricting, as required by the Constitution. The long form was used to identify much of that breakout in whatever dimension that I was mentioning, defining our nation's demographic characteristics and so on and so forth. The problem was that when that was only done with the decennial census, it was very old. It would not come out until, for example, last time, 2012 or 2013, and until that point we were relying on 2000 census data. So the American Community Survey, it was developed as a way of providing more up-to-date information on those demographic and other characteristics that this data source provides us, rather than being later and slower to be released as it was during the decennial census. But the decennial census doesn't provide that kind of information anymore.
Mr. Hine, any other questions, Representative Anderson?
No, not right now. Thank you.
Mr. Hine, quick question for you. So how does our immigrant workforce participation rate compare with the immigrant workforce participation rate in other states?
Mr. Chairman, good question. We have across all of our population subgroups, it seems to me, higher participation rates. So I can certainly provide that information. I can dig that out of the American Community Survey data. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I will hazard a guess that our participation rates overall are among the nation's highest, and the significantly expanding proportion of those populations would suggest to me that they are not dragging us down in our state by state rankings. Yeah. And I would be happy to find out the answer to that and send you.
And Mr. Ryan, I believe that you are correct, and it would be great if you could share that with Ms. Rice or Mr. Seidel, just that we share with members of the committee, but historically Minnesota has done a really good job of our immigrant population does seem to, compared to other states, participate in the workforce at a higher rate than other states. In your opinion, what are the factors for that? Why, what does Minnesota do right, or what are other states doing wrong that makes Minnesota a place where immigrants are more willing to or more able to participate in the workforce immediately?
Thank you. Well, we do have a relatively highly educated workforce. Now, of course, a lot of that high education level does not necessarily get reflected in our Hispanic population, in our some of the other areas of that are important sources of our immigrant community. Some of our significantly contributing to that highly educated workforce. Southern Asian Indians, for example. But the fact that we have a very highly educated workforce, and combined with that, the ongoing need for the kinds of jobs that we often see Hispanics taking, you know, those construction labor jobs or janitorial jobs and so on, does lend a lot of opportunity for individuals that are willing to work at the wages that are available in those kinds of occupations. We do have a work ethic that I would hope would translate well into other communities that might have just arrived here.
So, I mean, in terms of, so you mentioned a couple of factors there. One is just culturally Minnesotans. I don't want to disparage other states, but we tend to have a good work ethic in the state. In addition, we have a significant portion of like H-1B-2 visas, so individuals who are coming across, who are coming to our country, who have a technology background, and there's a, you know, the IT sector has a negative unemployment rate, so
right.
A person shows up with those skills, they're going to be able to have a job. What other factors? Just, yeah. I mean, it just seems like, well, and again, it's a secret sauce. There's not one reason why, but are there other factors that we can point to say, hey, this is something that Minnesota's doing right?
Low unemployment rates, at least relative to where rates are nationally and in other states, to the extent that the great extent to which immigrants are coming here to work makes a low unemployment rate state a very attractive location. You're much more likely to accomplish what you came here to do if you come to a state with a low unemployment rate. We've certainly seen that translate into our large and growing Somali population, for example, back in the 1990s. We were the one state that had the greatest underestimate of our population by 2000 because there were so many individuals that came from other places as well, but Somalia in particular in the 1990s. And that was, by many reports, attributed to our low unemployment rate.
And so I think it's an important point you bring out, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but correct me if I'm wrong, is that some may feel that by having a large immigrant population growing in Minnesota that somehow this would displace workers or this would result in a high unemployment rate, and it's actually the contrary. It's a virtuous positive cycle, whereas a low unemployment rate acts as a magnet for qualified workers to come to our state who buy products, who buy services, who provide expanded economic activity, and therefore it creates more jobs, which creates a lower unemployment rate, which creates more of an incentive for people to work here. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think
that's sort of the perfect words to put in my mouth.
Thank you very much. I'll be careful. But, so I do think that's an important concept, is that to understand that net immigration into the state of Minnesota creates positive economic outcomes, whereas some may not see it that way, but the data shows otherwise.
That's right. And I think to build on that too, I think it's important to recognize the magnitude and the duration over which we're going to see a shrinking sort of, you know, the native-born traditional population here. These last 2 years, in terms of the proportion of our workforce of the future that are coming from these communities of color and the immigrant population are again only going to grow over quite a long span of time.
And to the flip side of this, if the trends hold and we continue to see a higher percentage of Minnesotans that we're seeing kind of the demographic trends here, if a higher percentage of Minnesotans lack a post-secondary education or they lack an ability to speak English well, I mean, that's going to be a competitive disadvantage to our state. And it would be wise for all of us to make sure that we have more people who can speak English well and more people who are, or at least maintain the current levels we have.
Well, low education and a lack of English skills are disadvantages that we can overcome.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, having been one of those unfortunate individuals that got caught up in that survey, and I'll say it's not a one-snapshot deal. It happens over a series of months that they continue to annoy you. And my question is having it over a series of months, I know in my own household, the statistics change. So at what point does this information come from? The start of that, or at the end of that, or somewhere in between, or where is that point, that data point at, that we gather this information? Because I know it changed quite a bit in my own household, so I'd have to believe there's a big change in all this for all the people reporting here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you were a victim of the current population survey, not the American Community Survey. I'm willing to bet.
All I know is if I couldn't fill it out, Mr. Chair, they threatened me with fines and jail. That's all I know.
Well, and they shouldn't do that because they don't have that authority. There is a sampling design within the current population that asks households for 4 months, and then they give them 8 months off, and then another 4 months later on, to get at over the time changes in these characteristics. The American Community Survey is only asked once a year. Also, I always like to bring this up, that we have more people that are Nielsen families rating TV shows than we have families answering the current population survey, which is the basis for, in my world, things like the unemployment rate, you know, which allocates billions of dollars of federal money and so on and so forth. So we do spend a lot more on our TV watching habits than we do on our employment situation, but I feel your pain.
Representative Howe, I know that sometimes I've confused the ACS surveys for those very aggressive solicitations from the Republican National Committee. So maybe that's right. Representative Mahoney.
Me too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your comments about immigrants and what they're going to do for tomorrow. Welcome to my world. I have the 14th largest Latino district. I have the largest Asian district, or one of the top two Asian districts in the state. And the idea of English as a second language and high school graduation attainment are big issues in my district. Because right now, talking to the people in the district, that's one of their biggest concerns, is how do they bring their children from where they are. They don't want them to be janitors or cooks or whatever. They want them to be the next set of lawyers, doctors, licensed construction workers. So this is really, really important stuff, because in 10 years, you know, our workforce will not be white, it will be beige. And if we don't address it, it's going to be, we'll become a cold Nebraska. Not that Nebraska's bad, I've driven through it, it's a nice state. I will say this, I am starting to see more and more companies and organizations reach out and grow that. I see it in my own Pipefitters local. When I first started, there were two Latinos in the whole organization. And today, they constitute about, say, between 8 and 10%. And they have to go out and find the people who are willing to do the work. I'm kind of shocked that most people don't realize the wages that you can make as a good construction job. So I'm grateful that you came with this information. You've come to this committee a couple of times with this information, both in the Latinos and the Hmong and all of our immigrant. We as a committee need to start taking your advice to develop some policies that will, whether they're Somali or Latino or Asian, develop the policies that will put that group of young people into a workforce at a level that creates good jobs, good tax base, and a strong economy.
Mr. Ryan, any closing comments before we go to our next testifier?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to come. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Thank you very much. Next, I believe, do we have another person from Deed that's going to be testifying? No, okay. So, Eric, I don't want to screw up your last name. I'll just say that you're the legislative and policy liaison from the Minnesota Council of Latino Affairs. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
I also have individualized handouts for all of your
great.
Sure.
I'll take mine. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Eric Markanke. I'm one of the legislative liaisons with the Minnesota Council of Latino Affairs. If you just allow me to connect my computer quickly so we can get the slideshow back.
Yep, take your time.
Oh, ma'am.
I'll take
mine.
These are
statistics.
Yes.
And we got,
I got six. Oh, who's passing them out? Oh, negative. Yeah, they're customized. All right, you figured it out.
Got it.
No, we need Representative Makeway to study the demographics of Representative Newberger's district.
Oh, Representative West.
Representative West.
It's like, Mr. Chair, it's like returning quizzes in middle school.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'm prepared whenever the committee's ready.
We'll wait until everyone gets the card there.
Oh, sure.
Are we good to go? Does any member not have their district yet?
They're coming.
Okay. And thanks for making these customized reports. Sorry I screwed up the delivery of them.
Didn't mean to make it challenging.
You did it right. I did it wrong. Are we good?
30% higher median income in his district than mine.
All right, please continue with your testimony.
So again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I'm very excited to discuss the important economic contributions that Latinos are making to Minnesota. And so to do that, I have a few slides, and I'll go over some demographic, geographic, and economic data, and then we'll finish up going over our agency's own community outreach and what those economic development findings were. So to begin, right now in Minnesota, there are about 288,000 Latinos in Minnesota. This is about 5% of the state's total population. But what's important to keep in mind, and kind of what we went over in the last slides, is that this number is fast and it's growing. But what I think is particularly important in this map is the top five counties. And if you look, that is all greater Minnesota. So Nobles County is 27% Latino. If you go to Wilmer in Candiota County and you speak to their school principal, he'll tell you that in 2 years he expects his high school to be over 50% Latino, Somali, and Hmong. And so what this really means is that Latinos and other immigrant communities are very important for greater Minnesota. And so now we're looking at the age distribution. Again, we've kind of talked a little bit about this before, but what we see is that Minnesota is an aging state. We have a lot of baby boomers, and the workforce of tomorrow is the Latino community and other immigrant communities. So 40% of Latinos in Minnesota are under 18, and of that 40%, pretty much every single one was either born in the United States or in Minnesota. But if you look at that median age of a 24-year-old Latino Minnesotan, I kind of like to ask the question, who is this Minnesotan? What are their characteristics? Well, they were probably born in the state, they're bicultural, they're bilingual, and they often have a higher educational attainment than their parents. However, they still face some pretty large achievement gaps. And so we'll see how that plays out in the economic data that I'm about to go over. So now discussing major industries of employment, I'd like to really underscore that this is specifically immigrant Latinos. We're not talking about the many third or fourth generation families that live in the state. This graph is specifically about the new immigrant Latinos that we have here. And so you'll see a very heavy participation in the service and manufacturing industries. However, what's really important, actually, is what this graph does not show you. And it does not show rate of small business ownership. And small business ownership is a very important part of the Latino community. There are a lot of small business owners, and there are even more that want to start their own small business. Because right now, in the state, there's really a culture amongst the Latino community of hard work, of entrepreneurialism, and self-sufficiency. And so a lot of people are wanting to go into small business ownership. So now looking at the labor force, Latinos are vital contributors to Minnesota's economy because they have the highest labor force participation rate in the state. As you can see, that dark blue bar is very high. However, that orange line, which represents median income, is quite low. And so what that really means is we need to try and find a way to make that gap a little bit smaller. And again, the trend continues. The highest employment rate in the state, the unemployment rate is a little bit higher than average. However, when you have such a high labor force participation rate, you're also going to see a little bit higher of an unemployment rate as well. This slide and the previous slide really shows is that the issue in the Minnesota Latino community is underemployment. It's having too many jobs. It's 2 to 3 part-time jobs or 1 full-time job that really doesn't cut it. And so I think what that really means is that as a state, we need to be investing in career pathway programs, because the issue is not having people working. We have a lot of people that are working, particularly in the Latino community. The issue is, you know, we don't have these pathways set up, and I think we need to keep investing in that. And now to finish it off, you know, I like to think of my previous slides and the previous slides from Deeds as maybe that overarching umbrella, and I like to think of this slide as kind of that person who's holding the umbrella. You know, who are we actually talking about? And if you recall back to the first slide, which are the top 5 highest counties, that was all greater Minnesota. And so this summer we were on the road, and we went to 7 cities throughout more or less southern Minnesota. We had a really well-rounded approach. During the day, we would hold stakeholder meetings, so that's a mayor, that's a county commissioner, a principal, a local workforce center, and then at night, we would hold community listening sessions, and we had really great turnout. As you can see, 130 total participants. And so what were our findings? Well, 1, affordable housing. I know this committee is aware of affordable housing. Affordable housing transcends race, age, gender, socioeconomic class, and the Latino community is no exception to that. 2, we heard a lot of stories of lack of upward economic mobility. I remember a story from a father in St. James who had the same job at a plant for 25 years, and he was talking to me and he said, you know, I haven't taken a day off in 25 years. I take extra shifts, and yet I see everyone around me being promoted. And he's not complaining, he's just stating the facts. And that story is not unique to St. James. We hear it everywhere. And so it's just kind of this trend of seemingly no or little economic mobility within the Latino community. 3, wage theft prevention. Chair Garofalo, I know you spoke passionately about stopping wage theft in Minnesota, and we hear the same thing on the road. And number 4, again, small business development. I think this speaks to our emerging entrepreneur program that was, I think, rolled out in 2016. And, you know, I'd love to see more investment in that, because the demand is there, and people want to take advantage of these services, and we hear this countless times. And then just to finish it up, I'll go over some of the pictures. The kids up there, and then the bottom picture is us in Northfield, and if you look closely at that upper right picture, that's our very own representative Baker, and he joined us when we were in Wilmer. And that takes care of it, so I'm happy to answer any questions y'all may have. Thank you
for your testimony. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Sundin, and then Representative Makeway. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to finish up some thoughts on the previous question of yours, what Minnesota is doing right as far as the workforce here in Minnesota. I'd just like to remind the committee that 31% of the apprentices participating in union apprenticeship programs are minority status, are doing an excellent job. That should be just to follow up on Mr. Representative Mahoney's comments, and they're teaching English as a second language as well. But going back to House File 1119, that addresses the unlicensed home construction. A lot of the unlicensed building crafts employ minority workers, and I'm just wondering how many of those are in fact included in these statistics here that we're reading today. Because if and I know some of them are undocumented workers, and I just wonder how accurate some of these numbers are, and if they do include undocumented workers, and if they do or don't, how would that skew the numbers that you've given us today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cindy, and members of the committee, I also use the American Community Survey, and anyone who receives that survey and fills it out can. So these numbers could include people who don't have that documentation. It also could not. I guess to be blunt, usually if you don't have that documentation, you're probably not going to fill out a survey that comes from the U.S. Census. So underreporting is an issue. I'm pretty sure in your individualized reports, I say at the bottom, that take these numbers more as a good estimate, but you know, don't think it's exactly 68.3 at the same time either. When I've looked at numbers, when it breaks down to foreign-born immigrants that don't have that documentation, a lot of the workforce and numbers go up. So higher labor force participation rate, higher employment rate, and I hope that answers your question.
I guess I would just say that it's important that we do this work and document some of those people however we can, because if they're going to contribute to the economy, I think they should contribute fully and pay taxes and Social Security. We've seen all the statistics today that we're going to rely on most of the immigrants to pay our Social Security bill.
Representative McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the labor force and income breakdown by gender, and I noticed that male participation is much higher than female participation. When you did your meetings, did you anecdotally or maybe statistically hear why that it's like that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question. There were not any anecdotal stories that I heard. With the absence of that, I don't want to hazard a guess at the same time either. I'd be happy to follow up with you more and look into this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just maybe directing your attention to one of the things I hear from all women and not just Hispanic, Latino women is child care, cost of child care. And so they're kept out of the workforce because they wouldn't make as much money as it would cost to send their kids to daycare, and then lack of access to it as well in greater Minnesota. But I just really quickly want to comment on the last two presentations, and you know, we sit on committees, and so we have areas of jurisdiction, and we talk about certain things, but none of these issues live in silos, in particular when we talk about communities of color. And so if we're looking at the jobs that folks that are Hispanic and Latino are in, and they're in restaurants and serving and home health care workers. I look at preemption bills and not investing in home health care worker raises. We're talking about English as a second language and not being able to speak English well as a barrier. Well, when we cut education budgets and ESL teachers are cut from classrooms, like, these are things that happen. And so I think it's really good that we have this data and that we are talking about this today. I just want to remind everyone in this community that it doesn't just happen here, but it happens from our uninvestment in communities over and over and over again, in particular like communities of color. It's why we bring it up all the time. It's why we talk about it, because our future is going to continue to look like this if we don't make the strong investments in our state that we need to.
To the test, any other Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about the issue of affordable housing. I have the honor of having one of the highest rates of Latino populations in the district, in the state, in my district, 24%. And one of the major issues right now, and as you mentioned around the state, is the issue of affordable housing, especially the issue of gentrification and rental rates going up in, basically under cared for housing. Can you talk a little bit more about, I know you have that as number one issue here. Can you talk a little bit more about your findings on that?
To testify? Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, members of the committee. Speaking from our greater Minnesota community outreach, it's really both an issue of finding housing to begin with, and then if you find housing, is that housing affordable? I know in Worthington, we were speaking to both community members and some of our stakeholder meetings, and they talk about how they shipping a bus of people from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, because no one can find housing in Southwest Minnesota. And so I think that gives a good context of kind of the issue within greater Minnesota, speaking specifically to the Twin Cities. A lot of rising apartment costs and coupled with stagnant wages is displacing a lot of people that have had that apartment for 5-10 years.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? To the testifier, thank you for taking the time to testify to us. I do think it's important just to highlight in the data that you have that particularly among Latinos, we have this very strange dynamic where it has higher workforce participation rates compared to other racial components, but that the median incomes are lower. And as that segment of the workforce continues to grow, this creates a competitive disadvantage for our state. And so just like it is inaccurate to say that people of color try to design a one-size-fits-all solution for a workforce and developing our workforce going forward when comparing it to white workers, also each individual racial subcomponent has its own characteristics. And as we go forward, that issue on the far left, I kind of have it circled on my diagram here, it's just important that members be aware of that, that you know, this is not a matter of people not participating in the workforce. They are participating. They're over-participating in the workforce. And so I know the state of Minnesota, we do a lot of things to try to address these problems. We spend a lot of money. We're going to hear from one of the groups that does that coming forward. But just to highlight that point for members of the committee so that they're aware of it, and thank you for your testimony. Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just one more question. Have you, by any chance, as an agency, had a chance to look at the impact of the pending DACA federal legislation and proposals, how that will affect these numbers, and I'll just leave it at that. Have you had a chance to look at that and provide any estimates yet?
Representative Clark, there's many proposals going forward. Are you talking about the Trump-Schumer-Pelosi compromise plan? Is that the one we're discussing right now, or is there a specific one you're looking forward to?
The latest proposal from the president, I think, is probably the one we should look at.
Well, there's been a couple different proposals. So,
I know.
Okay, the most recent one, and I was being half facetious but serious, is the Trump, Pelosi, Schumer plan.
Sure, let's talk about that one.
Okay, so.
But did you check Twitter this morning?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it changed. So, for the testifier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have an education liaison that will be able to give a much more robust answer to that. I'll say that I believe, of DACA recipients in Minnesota, there's a sizable number, but it's not the majority of the youth that are Minnesota Latinos by any means. I think if you speak in broad terms, usually about maybe one-third less of the Latino population in Minnesota does not have a Social Security number. So then if you can, kind of scale that down to people that would be DACA recipients. So I'll leave it at that. Without giving an exact number, I'd be happy to give exact numbers after consulting with our education liaison. However, I will say that the numbers from DACA show extremely high employment rates, higher than this, people getting into excellent careers, and it's also a lot of young people, so it's that median age and lower. And if you think about our workforce of tomorrow, does include these people, and they have they're striving hard for good paying jobs, and a lot of them have achieved that, and it's amazing to see. And with that in mind, you know, if we want to lower that gap between a high labor force participation rate and a low income, we need to kind of make sure to support programs that are showing measurable results in lowering that gap.
Thank you. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions or comments, thank you again for your testimony.
You.
Next we have Ruby Lee and John, is it Pacheco? Am I saying it right? Right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record. Who we represent?
He's being a gentleman.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Pacheco, and I'm the Workforce Initiative Director for CLUES, Unidades Latinas United in Servicio. I do have a lot of numbers, and you've heard from both presentations, so what I'm going to do is really kind of talk a little bit about what we're finding when we're going out in the community. And as you know, because of your both generosity and support, we've been working with the Latino Workforce Initiative for about a year and a half now, and that was to address the training gaps as well as the workforce gaps in Minnesota. And 50% of the resources would go to Greater Minnesota. So what I'll do is just share a little bit about what we've been doing over the last year, and then our president can talk further about what we're going to be addressing coming up and how. And so what we've done is we've really taken a look at and stepped back and going into the communities. And right now, beyond the metro, which is historically our base, we've also included Rochester, Wilmer, Mankato, and Austin. And rather than coming in with the community with the answers, if you will, we looked around what is the need in the communities, what is the, as far as workforce, what are the employer needs, what does the Latino community need, and then how we can assist in pulling that together to address all the different needs. And it's been an interesting ride because when you're going into the communities, everything is different. In the metro area, we do work with the unions, and we have painters, pipe fitters, bricklayers. So we do some pre-work called Bridge to Your Future, where we recruit members of the community and look at their skills. Are they ready to do an apprenticeship program or another program going forward? And so what is your English level like? What is your math like? And what is your skills on meeting people and customer service? We also do customer service training. And we've found that that's most successful because it's not only helping them get ready for a job, but while they're there, we provide a navigator. And right down in the metro alone, we have eight coaches or trainers. So for 1 year, we work with the individuals. In Greater Minnesota, we really did ask, what is it, without, again, a preconceived position for us to go and work specifically in an area. What we found more times than not was healthcare and construction, especially in Rochester, with Mayo being the big dog in the yard, if you will, and their needs for healthcare. But across the board, whether we were in Wilmer or Mankato, there's a growing aging population that's needing services. And so the local hospitals and assisted living facilities were coming to the table saying, we need trained workers and we need them now. And so we started a cohort in Rochester where we're actually starting a second one in CNA training and look at how we can match healthcare. It's an interesting one given your numbers because we have state's youngest population. And what we're doing really is getting ready to serve the state's oldest population. And how do we align these better needs in healthcare with the workers that we have? That's one area. The other one is in the trades, with whether it's a destination medical center or the construction you see in both cities here, is how are we preparing workers for that and the level we have. Now, the original question was, you know, there's the overrepresentation in the sense of we have a lot of jobs. We're employed. But yet the wages are so low. And there's a number of factors in that, and one of the points too that was mentioned twice already was the role of small business. Small business Latinos tend to hire Latinos, and immigrants are more likely, twice as likely to start a business than the other populations. And so when we do that, if you're employed, you may be unemployed and still own the shop.
So that's impacting some of the work. The other is that once the workers get going, they add another job, and they don't have time to go get the training to move up. And often the companies haven't been able to provide that training because they just keep the line running, whether it's Hormel or the others around the country, around the state. And what we found there is for Hormel, for example, is looking at, they're working 12 hours a day, and sometimes they're now looking at maybe pulling them off the line for a couple hours to get them trained so they can become the welder and the others that run the machines versus the production. So I think what's changing also when we went out there is that people want to be trained, people do want to move up, and then the industries are now, because of the tight market, are in competition with each other, whether it's even nursing. CNAs don't make that much, but they're willing to pay a little bit more. And our goal is not to train CNAs. We want to get to the nursing and to the other professions, but we want to keep them in this path. And that's where our navigators come in. We do provide that backup for 1 year. So we're seeing more of the employers coming to the tables. The unions actually have set up a number of shops where we could go in weekend or evening. We have a nonprofit in Rochester that just started evening and weekends for nursing. Now we still face the traditional barriers, I mean, especially in Greater Minnesota, the issue of transportation and housing is still very tough to get people back and forth to work in a safe environment. And so we're finding that once we're involved with the family, and we do work with the whole family, it's not just getting an individual job, that we're becoming more successful at it. We're having more interaction with the businesses. Like I said, in Wilmer alone, they have 52, you know, small business, Latino-owned small businesses. And you multiply that across the state. Hardworking folks, very family-oriented, so sometimes you're working that long because if you leave someone else to... has to jump in. So with that, I'll leave it. Again, you've had some numbers, and with that, as president, we relate.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ruby Lee. I'm president of CLUES. First of all, I want to thank you for opening this space to have this conversation targeted to the Latino community. So thank you for doing that, and I hope this is not the first, but this is not the only one that we will have going forward. Today, given the time, I thought I would pinpoint specifically some of the things that you're interested in hearing. What are we hearing on the ground? Just by way of introduction, I also serve on the Governor's Workforce Board that at the state level represents all the initiatives that are happening. Or not happening. We also just created an equity committee that will be focusing on, looking at how does the education, human services, indeed come together to help advance these things. For my comments today, I'm trying to channel some of our young staff who are working with clients, and hopefully I'll do justice to their learning. Some of the things that they're hearing and that they're seeing is that adults are not coming to us for a career. They're coming to us for a job. I think the numbers that the Council, Minnesota Latino Affairs Council, presented are quite telling in how high labor force, low wages, right? So as John said, with your support, we've been able to advance some of these strategies or tactics, if you may, but we're trying to learn at the same time and be flexible enough to adjust. So they're not coming to us for a career. It is key, I think, going forward that we look at that. How do we, not just CLUES, but other state agencies, meet people where they're at in their job, in seeking a job, whether it's a person that comes and gets a dishwashing job? How do you then work with, how can they work with coaches, like in our case, and build that into, how do you become a chef? Or, if you were working on roofing, how do you then become a business owner, or how can you improve your skills through our partnerships? So that's what we're working on a lot. The numbers that show the fields that a lot of Latinos are working in today reflect a high level in manufacturing and also in owning your business. Part of what my staff is telling me is that it's because sometimes that does not require a GED, or requires high level of skill language, English language skills. So those are things that obviously as we're trying to advance them into career development, those two things we are now providing at Cruz thanks to your support. So exposure to higher level positions or even awareness of them in helping them through coaches and navigators is key. I really appreciated the comments from Representative about child care. That continues to be an issue. Transportation and child care for mothers, it's critical and not available for our communities of color in particular. So what's working? That was one of the questions I was asked. Certainly this education and coaching towards career ladders is key. So investment dedicated to communities of color, I think in particular, or low-income communities is critical. Our coaches work with individuals for up to a year. So it's not just a training or not just a six-week piece. We provide the soft skills at Cruz for 4 weeks, and then they go to a specific training that they go to, whether it's for construction or healthcare, for up to 6 weeks or more. Stipends are critical. A lot of the investment contributed to Cruz to advance in this area, a lot of the money is going to pay stipends. As people are working three jobs, it's difficult for them to be able to take a training that lasts 13 weeks. So while we put in some money, it's just not enough money. So hopefully going forward, you know, more investment in stipends, more investment in employers also contributing to the advancement of career ladders within their companies. Leveraging resources and eliminating barriers, as I said, like transportation, working with the Department of Education, and looking at how can they invest also in youth. In some of the statistics, I just want to add what Latino youth looks like. You probably saw in the charts that Latino youth, we have one of the youngest populations today. Our median age in Minnesota is 24 today. By 2020, it will be 22. So we are the youngest growing demographic in the state. At the national level, 93% of Latino youth are U.S. born. So that's another number to consider. And in Minnesota, our Latino population of almost 300,000, 45% of Latinos in Minnesota are under the age of 21. So I don't need to tell you much more than that. Then the fact that our board and at Cruz, we're looking at how do we invest today in the future tomorrow, not just for labor force, but, you know, at all levels. These are the people that somebody mentioned, Social Security. They will be paying our Social Security. They will be investing. We want to keep them in Minnesota. But the investment starts today. We have limited resources, limited funding from the corporate sector even to invest in our Latino youth. They're not exposed to career development. They're exposed to what they know at home, you know, so getting a job. They need a $10, $11 wage through programs that are mentorship programs from ninth grade all the way to 21. We're able to expose our young people to more career opportunities, not only through mentors, adult mentors who have professional careers, but specifically Latino mentors who are making a big difference. That way they can see themselves reflected in them. We have today a youth program, for example, that covers around over 100 young people who mentors work with them from ninth grade all the way to 12th grade. And that has resulted into 100% graduation rate in high school. But they come out already with a mindset of what career they want to pick and what wages they're looking at. Lastly, I would say that our young people today come to us for careers in three primary areas, IT, nursing, and owning a business. We at Cruz are trying to partner with some of the corporations like Best Buy and 3M who are investing in technology. We're looking at expanding our building in St. Paul, our headquarters building. Best Buy just chose us to be one of the, in a very low income neighborhood on the east side of St. Paul, to have a teen tech center. This will expose our teens to coding, music recording, and film recording. And we will advance that into business owning based on technology. So these are opportunities that at the local level we can create uses pilots. With your funding, we've been able to begin to build some windows of opportunity so that we can bring others to leverage your resources or the state resources to expand in a targeted way. So I really look forward to having another conversation as you please and to answer some questions regarding what investment needs to happen in Latino youth going forward. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you both for your testimony. Questions and comments from members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. I'm just kind of basing this off of Eric's previous presentation, the data that he provided here, and I'm hoping you can help me out with some of the answers to my questions. It says 40% of Minnesota Latinos are under 18. What percentage of those do you, if you have data on it, can speak and write English?
So the testifier?
Under 18, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify. I would say 100% of them do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And thank you. I see that, you know, and I know Representative Mahoney brought this up too, but I see that as kind of the major barrier, in my opinion, for advancement in work, in jobs. And I could be completely wrong, but is that language barrier. And I think, you know, one of the bright futures for Latinos, I think, in the future of these young folks especially, is they are going to be bilingual and the opportunities that that's going to afford them. Nursing is one of those areas where it's going to be really beneficial for them to be bilingual. It's always beneficial if you know more than one language. But so I was just curious about the language issue and what you're doing to address that. If the people under 18 you think are 100% fluent in English, what you're doing for the rest of the population to help improve their language skills, English language skills.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, yes, the youth that we work with today are fully bilingual. But I do want to add the bicultural approach that we use too. It's key. And as I said earlier, the investment in career ladders, career, you know, more education and awareness about what the work could be, it's key in a culturally appropriate way, having mentors that match their ability. Regarding new Americans or immigrants who come to CLUS, we have for the last at least 30 years, CLUS has been in existence for 36 years, and I know as a member of the community, I've been connected to the organization and a donor to the organization myself. We have been doing English language classes. We still have a huge demand for that. Thus, we're looking at expanding our building. We only have 3 classrooms today, for example, in St. Paul, and in Minneapolis, we have 3 classrooms. What we provide is a multi-generational education. So when parents are receiving English classes, we have classes from 10 to 12:30 during the day and in the evening from 6 to 8:30. That makes a difference between what state government can provide because at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock offices are closed. We are open at night. We are open during the day. While parents are in ESL learning, and now we continued into GED thanks to the funding that you provided. The children are also learning about literacy, early childhood education, which we're not able to receive funding for that yet, so hopefully we will someday. But we provide STEM classes and English literacy classes through AmeriCorps. Today, the funding that comes through the state for English language learners is very limited. Probably 50 cents on the dollar that it costs us. So we deliver English language learning through volunteers primarily. We have over 700 volunteers who come to CLUS and about 2 staff both in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And now with the opportunity to provide more workforce training at the Greater Minnesota State, you know, in the 4 pilot communities, it is complicated because there is a system also about English language learning. And so it's about building partnerships and how we can add value and leverage what's already happening through through some systems. Thank you.
So I'm just assuming that the younger someone is when they come here or if they're born here, their proficiency in reading and writing English is better, and that the older they are when they come here, the more difficult it is for them to learn. Is my assumption correct?
Correct, yes. Okay. And I would say that it is learned, you know, sometimes in the streets with friends and whatnot, however old you are. But also, as I said earlier, investment in good literacy skills for children who are bilingual is also key.
And Representative Davitt, can I ask you a question? Because I think you might know the answer to this. If you don't know, just I actually don't know the answer.
It's the last time I raised my hand in this.
Yeah, I know. So the ELL programs we have in K-12, mm-hmm. I know that we provide additional resources for English as a second language students, and there was this debate about the 5 years versus 7 years, mm-hmm. about how long, because there was one side would argue that there was a perverse financial incentive for institutions to not teach kids English because then they keep the revenue stream longer. Other people would respond to that, well, no, it just takes 7 years to teach someone. Do you know where are we at in the 5 and 7 right now in the K-12 formula? I know what it used to be. I just don't know what it is now.
Sure. Mr. Chair, my understanding is we're now at 7 years, okay. That we changed that a couple of years ago, and I would imagine that the testifiers can correct me if I'm wrong. The other piece that I wanted to raise from K-12 that we've done is establish the bipartisan, as I said, strong support, Seals of Biliteracy program, which if you are a high school student and can pass a certain test in a language other than English, you get a little seal of biliteracy on your high school diploma. Now, that works if you're a native English speaker who takes another language in high school and is able to achieve. Importantly, though, it also works for native speakers of other languages who, of course, speak English because they've been in the K-12 system, but also demonstrate fluency in their native language. And if you achieve at that level, M-State, as they're now called, MINSCU, is required to give you college credit. So when we think about how do we get our immigrant populations into post-secondary education, providing them with an incentive by saying you've already got a toehold of college credit is one important piece. And I can allow the testifiers to correct everything I've just said.
Representative Dad, actually, I called on you before you raised your hand. Oh, you have another question, or was that?
No, that was. I just wanted to raise the importance of valuing the native language as well as the English language skills, particularly as we talk about the bicultural piece. And frankly, not everyone who, just as they may pick up their English on the street and informally, many may pick up their Spanish in the same way, and being technically bilingual is more than just picking up the vernacular at home.
Yep, and that's a 21st century workforce item, is that if you're bilingual, if there's anyone, I can't imagine there's anyone young actually watching or listening to this testimony, but if they are, if you're bilingual, your opportunities are, just like if you don't know English, your opportunities are limited. Learning English is one thing, but if you are bilingual, you have so many more opportunities in the 21st century economy, and that's just, it's exceptional. But Representative, I'm talking too much. Representative Lehman, then Clark.
Okay, I'll try to make this quick because I know we're out of time, actually. I'm just curious. I'm looking at my district, and I see that we have 500 Latinos in my district, almost half of whom are at the poverty rate. And so I'm wondering what is holding them in the district, and which leads me to a question about their mobility. Do you have, are you tracking, are Latinos more or less mobile than other populations? And, for example, do they stick with your program, or are they, you know, are they staying in Minnesota, or are they quite mobile?
Well, that might be. Do you feel comfortable answering that question, or should the department come down?
I gotta give you what I know, and you can still have them come down. Yeah, from what I've heard from when you had the meetings out there,
When you're in the greater Minnesota, most of the folks I talk to, particularly the ones even that are working a small business, they want to stay. For example, in Wilmer, they want to stay in Wilmer. They want their children to go to school in Wilmer. And that's when you're finding a lot of the population did come from either an agricultural background or a smaller town or community, and they feel that ownership of doing that. And then that's what I'm hearing again and again, that they would prefer to stay where they are, but where are the jobs? And then, but on the other half of that coin, what they're telling me is that often we don't get the notices for the local jobs until they're taken. And they gave me an example of one major employer that the only jobs that were posted were, in Spanish, were the cleaning jobs. Mm-hmm. Nothing else was posted in Spanish. And there were those kind of stories you go out and you see, and you know, it gets back to the question and the value of language. Mayo Clinic hosted 20-some health professionals from Latin America recently, and you're seeing more. And I've had conversations with a call center, and I said, would you pay them $1 more if they speak Spanish? And they said they would, but they didn't think of it. But that's a skill, and you're seeing more and more of that, to the chair's comment, that they're recognizing it as a skill, and they're recognizing we're a multi-global center here in Minnesota, and more that's going to be a necessity. So to answer your question, yes, they want to stay, but they need opportunities.
Representative Clark, you get the last comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question for each of the testifiers. I couldn't hear the third category you said that you were particularly working on, IT nursing, and what was the third one?
Oh, that these are the categories that youth come to us for to learn, IT, nursing, and owning your own business.
Owning your own business.
Okay.
And then for Mr. Pacheco, you mentioned that one of the concerns was the ability to get safely to workplaces or not. And that's certainly not just in rural Minnesota, but all over. And so I'm just wondering, you know, one of the pieces of legislation that we've not invested in here is allowing undocumented Minnesotans to be able to have driver's licenses. And so I just wonder if you comment on that. It seems like an important investment. I know many of the rural chambers of commerce, milk producers, landscapers, others have wanted us to take a vote. We didn't take a vote in this last session on that issue of undocumented, providing driver's license to undocumented workers. I'm just wondering if you could comment on how what that investment would do if we did that.
Chair Representative Clark, you know, transportation, that something like that could be a game changer in the community. I mean, the jobs are spread out, and if you're part of some of the jobs, they require you to not only have a license but a truck. And they do that there and have a clean license and all of that insurance. So having a driver's license and being able to go between these jobs would be a game changer for a lot of families.
Representative Mahoney, my apologies. I didn't know you had sought recognition, so you'll get the last word.
Well, thank you. I know we're over time, but I'm going to ask three or four questions that I do have anyhow. I'm not sure which one spoke to the trainers versus is it trainer and navigator, are they interchangeable?
I can start and then you can. We do have employment and workforce trainers and coaches. So we have about 8 coaches who will focus specifically on employment and employment opportunities. So what...
Okay, well, the reason I asked Mr. Chair and the testifiers to kind of get this sooner, the reason I asked about trainers and navigators, you made it sound like someone goes through your workforce training, and then they have a paid mentor, so to speak. I think that's a simpler term for us all to use and understand, that guides that person for a period of time, and Ms. Lee, you spoke to about 10 weeks total. I'm wondering if it's, and I got the impression it was longer from you. So my question is, which is it? Do they get a year, do they get 10 weeks? And what's your success rate for retention and wages if someone has a trainer versus someone who just comes in, gets the training and goes off?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, what we have is we have a trainer, and that could be 6 to 8 weeks, and depending on what we're providing the individual and what training we're providing for. So this is the bridge to your future. And so if we're looking at our next step, the trainer has the student come in. The student tests out, and they do the TAB testing. I can't remember the acronym. But they look at their English level. They look at their, are they ready to work? Are they ready to take on an apprenticeship program? And that goes on. So that's what the trainer provides. Once the trainer has, once the student has completed that, then they may go over to the apprenticeship program at the carpenters or bricklayers or painters for that apprenticeship program, and then they're in the queue. And once we get them in the queue, they actually are pretty well successful as far as getting a job and staying in there. Now, the navigator is different, and sometimes more important than that is that now you, let's say you are, and it happens whether union or whether you're in with the nursing, for example. And I'll give you the model real quickly in Rod and Wilmer. We have an education partner because we don't have certification to do work in Wilmer. So we have the Ridgewater College that does the training for us in nursing. We have an employer partner. We have two, actually, Rice Hospital and Bethesda Hospital that actually provide the clinical training and actually agree that if they complete, they will get an interview. They can't say you can have a job, but they have an interview. And then we have our navigator. Well, then we have actually the local community, Latino community organization, because they know what's going on there. But the navigator then, once you've finished your training, works with you for the next year. The navigator looks at how do we keep you engaged. What are your transportation issues like, your child care issues like? You know, sometimes you get very frustrated, and so it's that navigator role that actually is probably the linchpin of all of what we do. We have this training, nurses training in with the Red Cross, and they said we didn't have the success rate because we didn't have the navigator, so now we're doing the training there.
Mr. Chair,
and to the testifiers, it's something that's become so obvious to me that we don't do a very good job of it in people with no disabilities. The navigator, as you're calling them, is such a critical piece to making sure someone shows up for a job. When they get in an argument with their boss, they don't say inappropriate things or quit, or they don't have child care or their transportation is a problem. So the question I guess for you and the advice to the chair is that we start looking at navigators, so to speak, in all of our workforce programs. But how many navigators do you have how many trainees per navigator do you, is there a ratio that you try to stay at?
Right, and to the testifier, and it sounds like some legislators could use navigators too, right? So, to the testifier.
Yeah, thank you for cutting me off there.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Mahoney, this is our pilot. We have four of them going on now in the different cities. We finished two cohorts.
I can start by attacking Greater Minnesota.
Yeah,
in the metro, we have more.
Right, and so... And so the navigator is tied to a cohort which averages about 10 students. And so we now go, depending on what the training and where we are, given that point now, Rochester, we're just starting our second cohort, for example, in nursing. We start one in Wilmer next week. And the key to the navigator, too, by the way, is that they're not hired from the metro area, they're hired from the community that we're serving. So we hire a local navigator who's from the community, lives in the community. In the case of Wilmer, we're paying half, and the community college, Ridgewater, is paying the other half. They, we both benefit by having a bilingual Latino in town, if you will, in providing that service. And that's in Rochester. We have one full-time that's doing Austin and Rochester. And it really does depend on the model that we're doing. And then in the metro area, because we have a larger group and we have so many different cohorts, we've got about six to eight navigators.
Well, if I could, just to simplify a little bit because it's confusing. Navigators, if you can think about that also as wraparound supports. So in our organization, we provide health and wellness as well as economic vitality. So our navigators of resources and information help coach individuals in anything related. It could be chemical health, mental health, other things that can impact your advancement in employment. Then the coaches that I mentioned earlier are the ones that work with individual development plans around a career development. So that's very specific, which are, in a way, navigators, but they are the ones very focused on career advancement. And then we have the employment navigators, or the employment trainees or trainers, who help specifically with, you know, getting a job and also positioning people into moving forward with workforce training. So different ways of approaching it, but what is key to your point is that wraparound supports are essential to the success. In a little bit longer term as needed, up to a year is what we use for some clients with the aim of career development and not just the training.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, and to the rest of the committee members, I hope you heard we have our workforce training. We really do need to start looking at how we do navigators, trainers, or not trainers, but mentors to a larger group, because we're trying, we can't afford to lose anyone because we didn't do the right thing in our workforce, because the old white guys are leaving. So hopefully we'll address that this year or in the years to come. The other thing I did want to say is, if you've never visited CLUES, you really should. It's a wonderful facility. The expansion is going to be fabulous. It'll add more classrooms. And once you're done with the visit to CLUES, if you want to see, I think it's about 4 or 6 blocks of small Latino businesses from restaurants, all very good, but there's one I would not go to on Thursday night for karaoke night. I just don't go there. Well, all the rest of them for lunch or dinner, from El Salvador, Ecuador, Mexico. I think there's another one I'm trying to think of that I really like. But anyhow, there's a whole bunch of restaurants, a whole bunch of small businesses, from beauticians to automobiles. That's the neck of the woods. It's a great microcosm of the East Side and a small Latino community growing over there.
Correct. Thank you so much.
Oh, and then the old German church that is now a Latino church, it's fun to watch.
Members of, first of all, thank you again to our testifiers and everyone testifying today. Just a reminder for members of the committee, please do fill out the blue sheets and get them to Ms. Rice. I'll keep you updated on where it goes from there, no guarantees. Second of all, between now and the session, you can plan on the committee meeting twice, perhaps 3 times before session. Again, this is dependent upon other actions that are taking place. Is there any other questions or comments for the chair? Seeing none, good seeing everyone, and we adjourn. Thank you.